The Lord Jesus bless you, and greetings to you from Him. This morning, the message, I've entitled the message, two words: Whose Voice? Whose voice? There's a key verse that I'd like to read to turn our attention to the subject of the message, and then we will look at a specific account of the Old Testament, probably something that those of you who've read through your Bible have read many times. It's caught my attention every time I've read through it, and I thought and felt led to use that as a basis for some teaching this morning. Our key verse this morning comes from Proverbs 19, verse 27, which goes like this: Seize, my son, to hear the instruction that causeth to err from the words of knowledge. Seize, my son, to hear the instruction that causeth to err from the words of knowledge. We could substitute the word for instruction there. We could substitute the word advice, or counsel, or voice. The proverb writer here is calling attention to the fact that there are voices that we hear in our lives that attempt to gain ground in our choice-making, in our thoughts. There are voices that are available. From the beginning of human existence, there have been a choice of voices. Specifically, in the Garden of Eden, there were two voices. The voice of the Lord, first of all. The voice of the Lord spoke into existence in the beginning of time all that we see with authority. And then he also spoke to the first man and gave a command. But there was another voice that entered into the human experience that was different than the voice of the Lord. So we have these two voices now that speak into human experience. And it causes or raises the need for discernment. And I think as time has gone on, voices have continued and become more and more. So that in our day to day, I think there's more need for discernment than ever before. And yet, in the chatter of all the voices in our world today, and that attempt to influence our thoughts, I believe all of those voices can be divided into two camps. One of them is the words of knowledge that come directly from the source of good, which is God Himself. And other counsel or words that cause to err from that. There are words that we might listen to and voices that speak to us. The voice of the Lord that we hear that says, I created you. I bought you. I love you. I have a purpose for you. You are worth it in my sight. I have made everything available for you for your blessing and for your success. Now, the focus is not on us, but on Him. Those are given to us, those capacities are given to us, so that we understand who we are in His sight. But there are other voices who might come to us and say, you're not worth it. You'll never make it. You don't have it. You're worthless. Which voices are we giving heed to? Or there are voices who are saying, this is the way to go. Do what's in your heart. Do what feels good. All these voices bombarding us. No, that one's not right. Yes, this one's right. Look here, look there. There's all these influences in our lives. The proverb writer comes through here and says to his son, cease, my son, to hear the instruction that causeth to err from the words of knowledge. Well, we want to look at an account this morning where a man listened to some words that took him a direction that I have a feeling he regretted later on because of the consequences. We want to take some lessons from that. Before we go there, we're going to have a little history lesson here, and I tried to draw a little bit, and if you like to, if you look in the, most of you probably have maps in the back of your Bible, if you will find one that depicts the time of Israel when they had the conquest of Israel, when the Israelites were delivered from Egypt, they went through the journey of the wilderness, and eventually they came to the promised land after spending 40 years in the wilderness, and then began the conquest by Joshua, led by Joshua, and they conquered the land of Canaan. Before that time, as they came close to the land of Canaan, they asked permission to go through some countries that the king said, no, you will not step in on our property, on our land. And they made them go around. Some of them, they came out and fought against them. And the Israelites won. The Lord delivered them to their land, their property, to the Israelites during that time. And that happened over on the east, on the east side of the Jordan River. We have here the Mediterranean Sea and the western coast of Israel. And then we have the Dead Sea here, with the Jordan River coming up here to the Sea of Galilee. That sort of makes a line here. This is the east side of the Jordan. The promised land was over in here that God had promised to Abraham and to his seed. Now they had conquered, they had subdued a couple of kings over here when they came into this area. And after they had that land, before they entered into the promised land, there was the 2.5 tribes. There was the tribe of Reuben and the tribe of Gad and the half tribe of Manasseh that came to Moses and said, you know what? We like this property that we like this land. This is a good land. We have cattle. We have sheep, our flocks and herds. And this is a good area that's got a lot of grass for our animals. We'd like to stay here. The rest of you can go to the promised land, but we like it here. And Moses said, what in the world? Don't you remember the spies that turned the people's heart away? You're going to turn the Israelites' heart away from going in to conquer the land that God gave promise to Abraham. And they said, no, you don't get it. They said, we are willing to go with you into the land and conquer the land of Canaan. And when all the tribes have gotten their places, when they're all settled, we'll build we'll build cattle pens here and we'll leave our wives here, but we're going to go with you and we will help you conquer the land of Canaan. And after you're settled, then we will go back to our land over here. That was acceptable. So the area we're going to talk about this morning a little bit is this area here. In that area, right close to the Jordan River, there was about an area of about 20 miles wide, and it went from right down here just above the Sea of the Dead Sea and went on up here just below the Sea of Galilee. It was called the land of Gilead. It was the land of Gilead. The land of Gilead was known for its grasslands and nice good places for, and there was some forestry there too. But it was also known that there was evidently some ointment or something that they were able to extract from maybe some of the small trees, the balsam trees that were there, and they made a balm or an ointment that was healing. This was also incidentally the place where King Jehu later on was, he originated from this area, and also the prophet Elijah. There was a couple of things that happened in this land of Gilead, especially we'll begin here in Jabesh Gilead. It was at the top edge of the land of Gilead. Let me backtrack just a little bit and set the setting here. So we have some other peoples that are located around these two and a half tribes here. And there seemed to have always sort of been some conflict with some of these people and the Israelites over the years. We have Edom down here at the bottom. They were the descendants of Esau, which was the brother of Jacob, the Israelites. So they were actually relatives, the Edomites and the Israelites. Then we have the children of Moab. If you remember the story, when Lot was taken out of Sodom, and Sodom and Gomorrah were destroyed with the fire and from heaven, and he got scared and he fled to the mountain, up into a cave with his two daughters. His wife turned to a pillar of salt on the way when they were fleeing Sodom. And Lot was there with his two daughters, and they had a solution to the fact that they won't have any offspring because there is no man around. So they they had a relationship with their father, both of them, the two daughters. And the Moabites was from the older daughter. And the Ammonites, which lived over in this area just above the Moabites, these would have been descendants, these would have been cousins to each other. The Ammonites were from the younger daughter that had a relationship with her father. And then north of the Ammonites, we have the Syrians. We have Syria. And there was conflicts with these people groups all the time. The Israelites recognized the Moabites and the Ammonites as distant relatives, but not nearly as close as the Edomites. The Edomites seemed to be a little, they were closer descendants because they were descendants of Esau. In the early days of Saul's kingship over Israel, a king from the Ammonites named Nahash decided he's going to go up and he's going to conquer, or he laid siege to Jabesh Gilead, to a city up there. The Ammonites attacked Jabesh Gilead, and in the process, the people of Gilead appealed to Nahash for a peace treaty. They said, make an agreement with us. Nahash's negotiation was that I will make a treaty with you, but this is the condition of the treaty. All of you are going to put out your right eye, and then I will, and then you'll be my servants. Well, the men of Gilead thought that's a little harsh. They said, give us a little time. Give us 7 days. And Nahash agreed to that. But during that 7 days, they sent word to Saul, new King Saul, that had just been anointed, and I think he was over in here. He was from the tribe of Benjamin. And they asked for his help. Well, Saul, of course, these were some of Israelites' the relatives here, so he said, yes, we will come. And when he found out about this threat from Nahash, the king of the Ammonites, he said, yes, he got a whole bunch of soldiers and headed out for Jabesh-Gilead. They had to cross the Jordan, and they went over there. And Saul was successful in that battle in defeating Nahash and rescuing the Jabesh-Gileadites and gaining their loyalty. From that point on, Jabesh-Gilead was, the people there were very loyal to King Saul. In fact, later on, after King Saul died in the battle with the Philistines, along with his son Jonathan and his other, they were defeated by the Philistines. It was the men of Jabesh-Gilead that went out and got Saul's body and gave him an honorable burial. After that, David came to kingship after some conflicts with the residue of Saul's family and his army. David came to be king in Israel instead of Saul. And David commended the men of Jabesh-Gilead for giving Saul an honorable burial. After David was king, he found out that Nahash died. And that brings us to our account that we will read today. I invite you to the text, which is in 2 Samuel 10, and we will be reading verses 1 through 7. Second Samuel 10, 1 through 7. And it came to pass after this that the king of the children of Ammon died, and Hanun, his son, reigned in his stead. Then said David, I will show kindness unto Hanun, the son of Nahash, as his father showed kindness unto me. And David sent to comfort him by the hand of his servants for his father. And David's servants came into the land of the children of Ammon. And the princes of the children of Ammon said unto Hanun, their lord, thinkest thou that David doth honor thy father, that he hath sent comforters unto thee? Hath not David rather sent his servants unto thee to search the city, and to spy it out, and to overthrow it? Wherefore Hanun took David's servants and shaved off one half their beards and cut off their garments in the middle, even to their buttocks, and sent them away. When they told it unto David, he sent to meet them, because the men were greatly ashamed. And the king said, tarry at Jericho until your beards be grown, and then return. And when the children of Ammon saw that they stank before David, the children of Ammon sent and hired the Syrians of Beth-Rehob and the Syrians of Zobah, 20,000 footmen, and the king of Maacah, and 1,000 men, and of Ishtob, 12,000 men. And when David heard of it, he sent Joab and all the hosts of the mighty men. Chosen to stop there. The story goes on. But here we have King David finding out that Nahash, evidently, at some point, it indicates in the text here, that Nahash, possibly this is, it's assumed that this is the same Nahash that had attempted to take Jabesh-Gilead, but that was overthrown by Saul. At some point, it doesn't, there's nowhere that I could find what this kindness was that was shown to David at some point. It could possibly have been assumed that when David was attempting to flee for his life from Saul at a young age, that it's possible he had some interaction with this Ammonite king who also had Saul as a foe, in a sense, and showed him some kindness, some provision, somewhere along the line. But it made an impression on David, so much so that when he rose to power as king of Israel, and this king Nahash of the Ammonites died, his son rose to power, became king of the Ammonites. His name was Hanun, if I get it said right. And David said, at a time like this, I want to show or return the kindness to Nahash, to Nahash's son, in memory of the kindness that his father showed him. So he sent some comforters, some men, a delegation from, I assume, Jerusalem over to the Ammonite country here, and they came there, expressing their condolences. But Hanun had some, the princes or leaders of that country came to him and spoke to him some words that influenced him and his direction. And that's what I'd like us to think about today. These leaders spoke to their king and said, "Do you think for a minute that this powerful king of Israel, who's conquered all the land around and who's been so successful, do you think for a minute that he sent comforters over here to comfort you in your grief? He is likely taking advantage of your weak time, of this vulnerability in your life, and he's going to take advantage of it, and he's looking out for his own advantage." And those kind of thoughts influenced him to shamefully treat David's servants that he had sent over there to comfort this man in his grief. Nahash's son, Hanun, renewed hostilities with Israel, the King David, by listening to some conspiracy voices, to negative assumptions, and that affected the disrespectful actions and brought sad consequences to the people of Ammon. When the servants of David left here, and by the way, you read in the text exactly what they did, and we could make a case here for beards maybe, because obviously the people of the Old Testament felt like a beard was either something of a maturity, it was something of manhood, it was recognized as wisdom, maybe? I don't know. Obviously, there was something to the effect, but they had beards. But there was something that this, what in the world gave this man the idea that, hey, let's shave off half their beards and send them home that way. But not only that, they cut their garments, and I suppose they had robes. I don't know. You can imagine. They cut them off right in the middle of their body and disgraced them and send them home that way. I don't know what in the world he was thinking that would accomplish. Can you imagine? He could have only known that was going to be a something's going to come out of that. And sure enough, when David found out about that, he sent messengers to those men that he had sent over to comfort them, and he said, "Look, I understand your feelings of shame. I'll take some responsibility for that." But he said, don't come back to Jerusalem right now, because I just hide out at Jericho for a little bit until your beards grow, until you get your, you know, till things kind of settle down again. But that was not the end of the story. When the Ammonites found out that this was not true, or somehow it says here, when the children of Ammon recognized that they stank before David, and obviously the children of Israel, they had a solution. They decided, you know what? We brought on a war. We stirred up the hornet's nest. We reached in there and we stirred it up. Now we've got trouble. So they had a solution. They went up here and they hired people out of this area, the Syrians. And they said, we need help. Come down and help us. We're going to fight. And they set up this war. And so the Syrians had one side and the Ammonites had the other, just outside the city. And David said, "Look, gather the men of Israel and go and fight this fight of the Ammonites." What a rebuttal. So the battle went on, and Joab and his men went out there, and he realized that there's going to be two fronts that he has to fight. So he divided the men of Israel. He took the cream of the crop, and he, with them, faced the Syrian army, and he turned the rest of the Israelites, warriors, with his brother. And he said, "You fight the Ammonites, and I'll fight the Syrians," Joab said. "And if the Syrians are too strong for me, you come and help me. And if the Ammonites are too strong for you, I'll come and help you." Well, it turned out that Joab gained on the Syrians and pushed them back, and they fled. The Syrians went hightailing back to their country, and the Ammonites saw that, and now they didn't have help anymore. So they retreated into the city. Well, this war continued, and the consequences continued. This war actually went on for some time, and it was actually the war that was going on when David was tempted and fell with Bathsheba. That conflict was when Joab was at the city of Rabbah, which was the Ammonite city of Hanun, which is where actually Uriah, the wife of Bathsheba, was killed. It was at that city and at that conflict later on. Joab eventually won that battle, but that's not the focus of the message this morning. But we know that all that transpired after that was not good. Back to the fact that this Hanun listened to the princes of the children of Ammon. We can expect these kind of events in the political arena. These uprisings, these suspicions, these accusations, these things that go back and forth, these conspiracy theories, if you will, the right against the left, and the liberals against the conservatives, all this kind of thing. But how about among so-called churches of God, or among our own brothers and sisters in the church, or even the voices in my own heart? Let's see if this morning we can help Hanan see where he went wrong. Let's analyze a little where he did not cease to hear the instruction that causeth to err. What caused him to treat others so shamefully? For some of these answers, I would like to answer that out of Romans 1, verse 21. The Apostle Paul writes there this verse, "Because that when they knew God, they glorified him not as God, neither were thankful, but became vain in their imaginations, and their foolish heart was darkened." Number one, where was your faith in God, Hanan? Where did you lose it? Why did you not glorify him as God? Did you not trust him? Did you not trust God's power to defend, to protect, to set up and put down whom he will? Did you not recognize that you came to kingship through the circumstances of your life, that God put you in position and that you could trust him? So where was your faith? Secondly, where was your gratitude, Hanan? Why weren't you thankful for the fact that you were not killed by rivals to your throne, to your father's throne? Many other successors were killed when the throne was available to them, but he was not. Where was your thanksgiving for your father's legacy of kindness with David, who was now in a powerful position to be allied with? He could have thought, what are the possibilities of allying with this powerful king of Israel, and the relationship they could have had that would have been mutual? But rather, he chose to imagine the worst. You know, I'll make a statement here, but I believe that gratitude would solve a host of social ills and be the seedbed of goodwill to our fellow men. Thirdly, why did you choose vain imaginations, Hanan, when you could have just as well chose to exercise positive thoughts and expectations? But Hanan, instead you chose to believe a lie of negative suspicion, which had no evidence. What kind of evidence did these men show in coming to show their care in this time? Hanan, were you jealous of David's overwhelming success, since he was your peer? Did you feel threatened and tell yourself, he's not going to boss me around? Does your father's kindness to David in his time of fleeing Saul not look the same as it does today, since David is a powerful king? You know, it may have looked different that time. I'm assuming that Hanan was possibly close to the same age bracket as David. And possibly when David was fleeing, it was okay for his father to share kindness with him. But things are different now when they're both in the king status and ruling. Now he's the possibility of taking me over. Hanan, don't you see that your choice of thought has affected your ability to make proper judgments? Hanan, it has darkened your heart and caused you to stumble in your relationship with your human brother. 1 John 2, verse 10 and 11, he that loveth his brother abideth in the light, and there is none occasion of stumbling in him. But he that hateth his brother is in darkness, and walketh in darkness, and knoweth not whither he goeth, because that darkness hath blinded his eyes. You know, we read in Romans 1 there, the progression, and it's not good, and we often put it out there in society. But how does this affect our own outlook sometimes when we choose this kind of thinking, especially in our relationships? Hanan, I have another question for you. Even if what you chose to believe would have been true, even if David had sent those men over there as spies, what about it? Is what you did as good as what you could have chosen to do in that situation? Does that make sense? Would you have not had more noble choices and responses than doing this shameful thing to these servants? Think with me about Elisha's response to the king of Israel when the Syrian army had surrounded and besieged the city where Elisha was. And God blinded the whole army. And Elisha went out and said, look, you're at the wrong city. Come, I'll take you to them. I'll take you to the city. And he took them right in, I believe it was to Samaria. And when he was in there, the whole army came into the city of Samaria. And the king, I believe it was Ahab, said, shall I smite them? Shall I kill them? And Elisha said, no, feed them. And he made a big feast to them. And you know what they did? They went back home. And it says this, they never bothered the Israelites again. Now, I didn't look at whether they did. I think that's credible. But what he did there was exactly what it says in Romans 12:20. Therefore, if thine enemy feed him, hunger, feed him. If he thirst, give him drink. For in so doing, thou shalt heap coals of fire on his head. Wow, that would have been an option. But these were not even enemies. These were friends. They came as friends, but you treated them like enemies. What did you put in their mind? Now look at the consequences you face. How about it, Hanan? Be not overcome of evil, but overcome evil with good. Yes, and this wasn't even an enemy. Hanan, did you not know the proverb that says, whoso rewardeth evil for good, evil shall not depart from his house? Oh, what a disgrace to bring that on yourself. Hanan, did you not think about it, that at any point in these consequences you could have recognized your failure and apologized and possibly redeemed the situation? Hanan, here's a question. Was your judgment a reflection of the motives of your own heart? canon. Did you know that people will often respond to our expectations of them? Think of the positive and negative effects these statements have on a person. You'll never do anything right. Versus, I believe you'll do an excellent job. How does that make you feel? One or the other? You know, the fact is, Hannon, God sent the greatest message of love, His Son Jesus, to us to comfort our hearts, to bring us salvation. But many choose to reject Him out of fear of obligation, of demands, of surrender of my position as king, my own boss. Finally, in conclusion to this message, there are a few words I'd like us to think about in the New Testament as it relates to Hannon and his response. This is the negative side first. In 1 Timothy 6, verse 3 and 4, the Apostle Paul is writing to Timothy, and he's talking here about things that are good things, and then he brings in the negative side here. If any man teach otherwise and consent not to wholesome words, even the words of our Lord Jesus Christ, and to the doctrine which is according to godliness, he is proud, knowing nothing, but doting about questions and strifes of words, whereof cometh envy, strife, railings, evil surmisings. And that's where I've chosen to quit. Notice the words he talks about here. Consent not to wholesome words. That sounds exactly what Hannon did here. He did not consent to wholesome words. He consented to words that took him a wrong direction. Words that were not from the Lord. Words that were not according to the doctrine of godliness. And I'm afraid he may have been coming into some of these conditions where it talks about here, about being proud, knowing nothing, raising up strifes because of evil surmisings, maybe envy. Evil surmisings, theorizing or reasons, suspect, supposing or imagining. On the other hand, what a beautiful thought that we have alternative. We have different things to listen to in 1 Corinthians 13, verse 4 and 5, where he says, charity, a heart of love, suffers long and is kind. Charity does not envy. It does not vaunt itself, is not puffed up, doth not behave itself unseemly, and seeketh not her own, is not easily provoked, thinketh no evil. Whose voice are you listening to, Hannon? Whose voice are we listening to? What is causing our choices and decisions? What is informing our actions? Let's allow the Spirit of God to lead us in productive ways in thinking rightly, allowing our minds to be fruitful ground for Him, to be a Jabesh Gilead, to be a balm of Gilead to those around us by our thoughts. Thank you for your attention. I would invite those of you who can to kneel in prayer.